I first came in contact with my friend, well, now my brother in soccer and many other things, Joel Bristol, in winter 2014. He was a senior at Coker College in Hartsville, South Carolina at the time. In the summer of 2014, he was planning on visiting his father's homeland, the Caribbean island of St. Vincent. I am from the island of St. Vincent, and I happen to run a soccer nonprofit on the island, and I've been going there every summer since 2009 to do such. In the summer of 2014, Joel was also planning on trying to get a tryout with the St. Vincent National soccer team. And so he Googled St. Vincent and soccer. When he did that, YouTube videos came up for my soccer nonprofit, the program I run down there for boys and girls in the summertime. So he watched the videos, got interested, reached out to me via email, and we started chatting. I recognized I had a valuable asset on my hands, somebody who played college soccer in the U.S., coached college soccer in the U.S., and actually wanted to go to St. Vincent. So when he was down there, I said, not a problem, come by, you know, where we do our program. He did that, stayed, coached the kids, did a fantastic job, and he's been back every summer with me since then, watching these kids develop, helping them get opportunities to go to college in the U.S. Joel is my friend on Facebook, and last fall, there was about a week or two where I could sense there was something going on. Like, these Facebook posts were, I mean, righteously and rightfully indignant to the status quo in America, specifically racism. But I'd never seen him be so honest, really, about his feelings on that topic. And so I said, you know, it'd be cool to reach out to you and speak about that because you have a unique perspective. He's biracial. Mom is white, dad is black. Again, dad is from St. Vincent. And they met in Florida and, you know, had him. And so I wanted to talk to him about that perspective. I wanted to talk to him about the things that were obviously going on in his head. It took us a while to get that done. He actually came up to Raleigh on a job interview last night, and we sat down and just talked. And we talked for about 5 hours. I got 5 hours of recorded conversation with my friend, my brother, about a wide range of things. Race, racism, his identity as a half black, half white young man in America, his identity as a new father. He's the father of a 15-month-old. His relationship to his son, his white girlfriend, her parents who may not still approve of the relationship. Relationship to his uncle on his mom's side, who has diverging opinions about, you know, blackness in America. So we talked about, again, for 5 hours, a myriad things that I'm going to end up making probably at least 2 or 3 podcasts, maybe even 3 or 4 podcast episodes out of them. The first drill we're going to drop right now is Joel talking about, unfortunately, the passing of his father. His father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2015. At that time, Joel made the decision to have his father live with him. And so he sort of watched him pass and helped him through that process. And so we talked about that, talked about the cycle or the circle of life that surrounded that. Because as his father was passing, Joel found out that he was going to have a child. And there was about a 2 or 3 month period overlap between the birth of his son and the death of his father. And so the significance of that, the meanings in that, the lessons learned from his father, because his father was not in the house as he was growing up. And you can imagine how close two people can come in dealing with death itself. And so we talked about that, and I hope you'll also stick around and listen to some of Joel's other thoughts on race, again, his identity as a half black, half white man, and what that has always meant to him, what that means to him now, how that influences or affects not only his thoughts, his needs and his wants to be a conscious, active participant in American democracy, but also how his ideas might affect the people around him. Again, his girlfriend's white, his mom is white, half his family's white. So how do you deal with that? So I hope you stick around and hear this first, I think, very touching episode about a young man having to watch his father pass, a father he may not have known too well, but in the last year of his life, somebody he came to love and appreciate and really got to know on, I think, a level beyond anything he could have imagined. We're talking to Joel Bristol, a friend of mine. Joel, how old are you?
I am 26. I'll be 27.
So young, my God. I keep forgetting how young you are.
Yeah, I'll be 27 in March.
You're really a man, I think, wise beyond your years. And I think anybody who's going to listen to you talk over the next couple of minutes or a little bit longer are going to get a good sense of that. But we're talking to Joel about a plethora of things. One of the things I wanted to focus on is what you brought up about your father passed away.
Of pancreatic cancer sort of combined with strokes. Kept having stroke episodes. Pancreatic cancer for men is a terrible survival rate. Found this stuff out as I absolutely.
And this is when last year, what month last
year?
He
was diagnosed March of 2016.
He passed when?
16 and passed basically a year later, the week of my birthday he passed.
What month?
March 23rd of 2017. My birthday was 29.
Right around the time you found out that
you're
about to have
a son. Did the funeral on my birthday. Yeah, did the funeral on my birthday and the wake, and then flew him to St. Vincent to be buried the first week of April.
Besides the year you spent with him while he's, I mean, while you're basically watching him hopefully recover, but unfortunately he doesn't. Was that the most prolonged time you've been with him?
It absolutely was.
What did you expect and what did you learn about your dad?
For me, I never grew up around my dad. He was always right around the street. He lived there. I saw him every weekend. Never lived with him. So there was never a dialogue with my father. He was either disciplining me or giving me an instruction. Or we're just talking about something fact of the matter. Like, okay, we're going here. Oh, how was school?
How often did you see him?
At least every weekend or so, unless he was away. He would go work on like the plantation, do orange picking and stuff like that. I was fortunate, more fortunate than my siblings in St. Vincent, to have grown up right near him all the time. I was his last child, so I think by the time he had me, that was the end of the very nomadic lifestyle, and he pretty much settled down there in Central Florida, bought a house, and so I was fortunate to be in the area. I remember when I left the college, my mom brought me over to see him, and they sort of had a moment, like, after all this, you know, our son's going to college. I was the first one in my family to go to college. A lot of my family struggled, you know, with addiction, with just law trouble or both. In a way, you know, and again, there's always so much worse. I hate to romanticize any sort of struggle, but within the contact family, I was sort of the rose that grew through the crack.
Tupac!
The Tupac, you know, so. I think for me, there was a little bit of pressure. I think a lot of expectations on my family. You know, they're very proud of me. But at the same time, I never thought of myself very highly. I think not in terms of self-esteem, but I didn't. I was like, whatever, I'm just going to college. I'm just going to play ball. You guys got it twisted. Like, I appreciate it, but I'm just going to play ball. But either way, my mom was, of course, very happy. And my dad, like, cried. Like, when I was leaving, we're pulling away. And my mom's crying. And I was like, joking with my mom. Like, oh, I thought, you know, you're gonna hold together. And she was like, well, I was crying because he was. And I looked over and like, I was like, I like caught him like tearing up. Like, I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, I had never in my life saw anything. So that was sort of the first glimpse. Fast forward now to when he's diagnosed.
No. Go back to that. So how did that make you feel? That was that heavy for you then?
That was heavy. That was heavy.
Because there's not that day-to-day interaction.
Never. And never an emotional
right
interaction.
Heavy in terms of the strangeness of it, or I visited a coach, a soccer coach that used to coach me the first year I came to this country at age 9. And I just thought he was in New Jersey, and I was on my way back to Brooklyn to see my family. And I thought, let me just pass by this guy's house. And I passed by his house, and I thought I would just, hey, man, I just want to thank you for everything you did. As soon as he opened the door, I just started bawling. It came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So was it that sort of
thing affected you like that, or was it just more surprised, like, holy shit, he does, you like, know, really
he's
feel
not an
shit.
Iron Man.
Right.
I think I was more just surprised to see him sort of crack a little. But of course, afterwards, you sort of, you know, it was a long drive. We literally, that was the last stop, and then me and my mom drove. She drove me all the way up, you know, 7 hours to Hartsville, South Carolina. And then, it definitely had time to sink in. I was like, wow, you know, I always felt he loved me. I never had any issue with that, like, feeling.
What was love for you then? What did he show that you're like, all right, this is enough?
Just being around, really. I mean, I think as a kid, you don't think of it from a social aspect like that, like a sociologist would. Like, Right. Oh, how is my childhood now being affected because my parents are not together? You're not thinking about that. You're like, oh, you're lucky you get more Christmas presents. or they're saying, oh, you're lucky you get two.
Right.
You know, you're split, so you got to go do it. So I just always knew that he was there. I always knew him. My mom never hid him. My stepdad never made any, they weren't like buddies, but they never would like just spite each other Right. Or badmouth each other. It was very open, like who was my dad and who
co-parent. The three co-parented.
They co-parented,
well.
I think. Well, you know, my dad's temper permitting, you know, at times, nothing legal or nothing crazy, but.
What is there an incident that you remember growing up about your dad?
I know him to have never been a drug guy, even if he rode in the car with drug dealers. This is in the 80s now, and all the yadmen are like running drugs up and down the East Coast from New York to Miami. And I know that his buddies now, because I hear all the stories now as a man, but I know that he never really smoked, he never did drugs, and he never really, I think, sold drugs. But I think he was like just an enforcer. I'm convinced now, like with the stories now at his funeral and post his life and everything sort of comes out of the dark. My dad was like an enforcer. Now it makes all the sense. Like, memories I have of my dad are like literally just riding around in Melbourne, basically in the hood, mm-hmm. and just shouting at, yo, like shouting at everybody. There was a time when he was like in a shootout, and I remember my mom said, you're never going back with your dad again.
Wait a second, you're in the car?
No, we're at the house, and the guy across the street, I think he was like schizophrenic or something, comes out and like slaps his like 70-year-old mom straight in the face. I remember this vividly. And then so they're all like, yo, don't do that. He comes over sort of in a very animated guy, very eccentric. Spent a lot of time at that particular house with my dad's friend, so I remember the place vividly. And I was sitting on a chair, and there was a cinder block, and he came over, and he was like, oh, sit there, let me take the chair. So as I get up, just, you know, out of respect to the elder, mm-hmm. my dad's like, no, he's sitting there. You sit on the brick. And the guy got mad, goes over, long story short, gets a shotgun, and is like basically like threatening the house, like shooting over the roof or shooting up at the trees in the mm-hmm. yard. So my dad and my uncle, he's like almost reckless brave. Like, he picked up like brick, told me to go in the house. And like, I remember like hiding like behind the couch on the wall. And this is the hood, so it's like brick square mm-hmm. houses. So like, even as a kid, I don't know why I was that conscious of it, but like, I knew I was safe behind the brick because he's shooting shotgun.
Okay.
And it's, I don't know why, but I remember thinking that, like, I'm safe, I can peek. And sure, the guy's like shooting. He's not really shooting my dad, but my dad's like throwing bricks at him. So that was like one incident. And then the next one was the first time I went to St. Vincent, same thing. My dad had a big sound system. That was like all his life investment was always in sound. A lot of records, a lot of sound. Shipped it over there for Carnival, my first time at Carnival. Some guy came in, like, I was in sixth grade. And
like 12, 13?
Yeah. And the guy, like, sabotaged my dad's sound. I remember my mom had just sent me some money on MoneyGram or Western Union. And I had to use it to bail my dad out because he beat the shit out of this guy for tearing up his music. So all my life, like, I remember my dad being someone who was very level, mm-hmm. very much liked by everyone, seemed like he had friends everywhere, knew everyone, was never a violent, never very outspoken, but had a temper. Like, if he was crossed, there was no going back. Like, he was a frightening man. Like, he never had to, I don't ever remember him striking me, except for one time when my mom caught me smoking weed, and he just came up and he said, stand right here. And as soon as I stepped on that spot, he smacked me across the face. He never had to physically discipline me because he was so damn frightening. Tall, heavy, dark, like just like warrior. Like, I mean, he just frightened me.
Saka Zulu.
Yeah, he never had to beat me because I was so frightened.
You left for college. Did he, was he a part of your life during your college, your undergrad years, or?
Yes, because I was now a man. So I was pressing that issue. Okay. I realized now that, oh, I don't really know much about my dad other than rumors or small talk. I never, and it started to bother me. I didn't know much about my dad. So when I would go home, I would, I remember it threw my mom off because like I was always so up my mom's ass. I was very a mama's boy. I was the man of the house most of the time. You know, I never trusted my brothers to do the right thing, whether or not they did or not. I was just very, I hovered around my mom. Mm-hmm. So when I first started coming back from college, you know, I started spending time with my dad and would spend, you know, extended nights over there, whole breaks over there and just visit my mom. And I think she hated it because she was so unused to that. So right as I got to college, yeah, that's when I started getting closer to my dad. Had some little issues. I remember going home like my sophomore year and taking to some doctor's appointments about like colon scares. And of course he's a yod man, so he's not getting no type of finger off his ass or any colonoscopy or whatever it is, prostate inspection.
Speaking of which, I need to go get one. 41 years old.
Yeah,
42 next Friday. Yeah. I need to do that.
So I leave for college, start to get more like adult dialogue going with him. Then he's like sick for, I think he has like a stroke issue. And then with the strokes, they're doing tests and they realize, okay, well, you got some other stuff going on. Pancreatic cancer is something that sneaks up on every victim. Every time you read about a case of pancreatic cancer, the survivability is so poor that they haven't been able to do a longitudinal study to get real results about it.
See, there's no signs, no nothing.
You go this whole time and it's like, oh, we thought it was your colon. Oh, we thought it was your intestines, or we thought it was gout, or we thought it was bile, or we thought it was something else. And then when they find it, it's stage 3 and 4 and 5. And I remember there was a teacher I had who I always saw posting about it because her dad died. Like, he was like, you know, relatively young age. And I always saw like the purple cancer ribbon. Then I start reading about it. So I remember I messaged her in the middle of the night, like, hey, you know, sorry to message, just one of my high school teachers. And, you know, she sort of gave me her experience and, you know, gave me advice. Look, just do whatever he wants to do, like bucket list it. Like, fuck all the, don't do chemo, don't do any of that stuff. So we didn't.
It is that terminal.
It's terminal.
But from diagnosis to death, it was a year and a couple months.
Yeah, so it's now my it's just 2015-16. So it's the end of the year, it's like 2016. And it was in March 2016 that I went home basically for my birthday, spring break in March, and he's in the hospital. My older brother would be very emotional. My little brother had no idea what was going on. I was always the one that had to like poker face it. And my sisters are like freaking out, they're crying. I had one sister in Canada I had never met all my life from St. Vincent who had immigrated to Canada. Met her for the first time in the hospital. So it was like this big emotional sort of thing. But I was very stoic. Like, I remember just having to be like very level. And in my head, you know, I had just been reading some Dr. Sebi. So I'm like telling my dad, oh, we got this. Like, you know, we're not doing chemo. We're going to keep it natural.
Who is this? Dr. Sebi?
I had been reading like Dr. Sebi. Dr. Sebi's like that? Alkaline versus acid, like your diet is medicine sort of thing.
Sort
like
of cures cancer. Natural cures. Stuff. Okay.
Roots medicine, okay. Yeah. Tried the idea of like change his diet, and at first that seemed like a great idea, but then there's a point where it's like, yo, within the next year, he may be dead anyways. So if he loves curry chicken, just fucking eat curry chicken. Because two more pieces of broccoli ain't gonna spare his life that much longer. You know, Ital or not. It is what it is.
That was yours. What was his perspective?
His perspective at first, I remember he called me. I got down there. He had the stroke. So I go visit him. And then, so I'm in Florida. I visit him right away. Then I was like, all right, I'm going to go make some rounds. I go around. My sister finally gets in town. Then the doctor says, oh, they had some news. My dad, remember my dad called me. Everybody was already at the hospital waiting on me, sort of just spending time with him. And he, remember, he called me. And again, this is sort of the first times I hear him crack. Like, and he's like, you know, choked up. He's like, I'm going to die. That's all he said. I was like, Daddy, what are you talking about? I was like, don't talk like that. I was like, I'll be there. I'm on the way. And like, I think like right then it's like where the dynamic started to shift and I become the father. Like I start to now take care of like once a man, twice a child thing. Mm-hmm. And so you get diagnosed with cancer. They tell us, you know, look, it could be 3 months. It could be 5 years. There's a particular cancer. It looks like stage 4 based on his condition, his health condition. It's not wise to do any sort of removal. Looks like there's a mass on his pancreas. Quality of life, palliative care. That was the prognosis, palliative care. I'm like, okay, nah, screw this. So then we start talking about going to St. Vincent. And at this point, this is where like it really became a crisis because I was expecting a kid. I'm living off a stipend. I don't have any money. He's disabled. He's working. He had broke his ankle like 2 years before that and is on disability. It's not working out. I feel like he was in Florida. He was too stubborn to let my sisters, I think, really take control of his lifestyle. And maybe they just didn't have the patience at some point. They get fed up because he's like starting to have issues with the stroke and memory. And but at the same time, he's still raw. He's still him.
How old is he?
He's 60, 59, 60 as it starts to happen, but looks like an ox still. Look, very much looks fit, doesn't look sickly at all. And he certainly didn't lose his attitude. So he was buck wild. Like he was, and there's one point where he had still been loopy from the stroke. My sister was saying, no, I'm not going to bring you over to your friend's house right now. We'll go another time. She comes back out of the living room. He's gone in the car. Ended up crashing it up the road and really had no idea what happened. So that started to happen, and then you know, there was a lot of turmoil in the family about who should take care of him, what should we do. Nobody wanted to do the nursing home thing. I ended up saying, look, you know, enough is enough. He's coming to live with me. I took him to St. Vincent. We did everything, just splurged, you know, just spent whatever I had available to me and, you know, went. The idea was for him to stay and live with his sister. We get there, realize just the infrastructure in place is just not really suitable for him. He just wasn't comfortable. I think he'd been very acclimated to America. And then here comes time for me to start packing up to leave. He starts like breaking down. My aunt called me. I was in town in like Heritage Square. And she's like, you need to come home. You know, your dad's like having like a panic attack. He's crying. He's like, don't leave him. So I was like, all right. I was like, I'll just buy a ticket. So I bought him a ticket again. I called my girlfriend like, hey, look, I know you're 8 months pregnant now. But, you know, this is what it is. And you know, I can't leave him here. And by now, we're sleeping in the same bed there in St. Vincent for a month that I was there. You know, I had been looking after him now for the last month or so. So we're starting to get very attached on the daily. Like, I even feel it.
What were you starting to feel? It's either you're in or out. Gotta know what you're all about. Be bold and strong. Tell yourself you're not doing wrong. Once you're in, you gotta take it. Make your mind up, son, and face it, because warriors don't cry.
It's almost like you have a twin, like you get a feeling. And like, sure enough, I'll get a feeling, I would come home and he would be having like some stomach pain or something. Wow. Or, and like, I feel like I felt that while I was in town. Or he wouldn't eat until I got home. We sort of shared each other's like vibes, and so I couldn't leave. I told her, look, he's coming to live with us. We had an extra room. She was very supportive, being that she was 8 months pregnant. You know, she did a lot of extra cooking for him in the morning, making sure there was basically like 3 meals a day, sort of structured, and just helping me organize, sort of take care of her medication, call this, appointment that, whatever it is. So there's literally times when she's 8 months pregnant looking after my dad because he was needing more assistance, started having to help him bathe, you know, help him eat, put on his clothes. And he really struggled because it was all just like, it was aphasia. It wasn't like he had just lost his mind. He knew what he was trying to say. It was an expressive aphasia. Like, you know what you're trying to say, but you just can't say it. And then you know what you're trying to do, but you've lost your motor skills. And all your life, you're a bad man. And now here you are, your son's taking care of you. And I think for him, he was very depressed. And then here comes Live With Me. I'm like, well, shit, I don't even have insurance. So what do I do now? I know he doesn't have insurance. He had like some Florida basic Medicaid. Mm-hmm. It wasn't for this state. So I'm like, so what do I do now? Something had to give. April's 8 months pregnant. My dad's, condition is getting worse. And I can't stop my day-to-day activities. Going to the field, setting up, training, traveling, driving buses. So the only thing that was left to give was these little online classes. So, of course, they started to struggle. I lose my scholarship. Pretty much, drop out of grad school at that point. About halfway through, 15 or 16 or so of 30 credits. I really thought I was on track. And then my son's born. There was a point where April was in the hospital downstairs and my dad was upstairs recovering from the stroke. Again, every time he had a stroke, same case. Won't listen to the nurses. He's trying to still get up and walk. So he was difficult. And he was difficult in the house too. There was times where I'd tell him, hey, I'll get this. And he wanted it then and not when I was ready to. And, he would try to do things that might be a risk. So that became more of an issue. April has the baby. Now, I'm trying to do both. I was running around like a madman and trying to still work. And then I picked up another job. So in this period of time, he's now needing serious medical care. And they're talking about, look, he might need to go into a nursing home to get therapy at the very least, even if it's not a permanent stay. But I don't have any insurance, no medical coverage for him or even for myself at the time. I was still a student under my mom. Turns out there's a doctor in town who's from St. Vincent, Dr. Michael Ambrose, who does general family practice. Takes my dad pro bono, and then long story short, gives me a job at a hotel that he co-owns as a bartender. And again, that's the case where I'm like, that has to be God. Like, there's no other way that happens. They're from the same place. We're the only two Vincentians within 100 miles, and he's a doctor who's equipped and ready to take care, willing to take care of my dad. Gets us, in with the prescriptions. Felt like we skipped some line, getting into the nursing home that was right in town, convenient, and a very nice one. I struggled with that. There was a point where, now he had to go in. He didn't want to do that. Then he was, I thought he was going to run away from the place, and then he's wanting to go back to St. Vincent. But it's still a case where now he can't walk. I'm more and more aware of the inevitability. He did some CAT scans. He had blood clots, old and new, all throughout his brain. His carotid artery was stiff and closing up. The pancreatic cancer sort of deregulates and screws up your bodily fluids. So his body was in like what they call the hypercoagulable state. His blood was getting very thick. So then he's on all this blood thinner medication, which means the internal bleeding from the cancer, whatever tumor and stuff is he's losing blood. And he had to keep going to the hospital and get blood infusions. And all the while he's getting atrophied, maybe on his right side, but he's still this big sort of imposing dude. He's always got his fedora on. He sort of kept his sort of same aura about him. So when people didn't know, when I would tell him, he's stage 4 whatever cancer, like, whoa, what? Fast forward a couple months, start to cope, get a rhythm with visiting him. He's getting acclimated to being in the place, getting used to, has some girlfriends on the nursing staff who love him and he loves them. And so he started to adjust. And the therapy was doing great. The speech therapy was doing good. The physical therapy was doing good. He really got to a level of confidence where he was coping, living with stroke. So sure enough, I buy 2 tickets. I tell my girlfriend, look, I know we just had the baby, but I got to sort my dad out once and for all. Try to go and fly him out. It was about March, the first week of March, where I bought the ticket.
So your son was born November 2016.
2016.
So in March of 2017, we're taking him, your dad, to St. Vincent for something different.
Yeah. Okay. His condition now got worse. He's in a wheelchair now. Even though he would have like memory issues or would be very aloof, He was so conscious, but so crippled that it was that. That's why he was so frustrated. He was so angered, and maybe so depressed for a long time, because he was like still in his head, but trapped by his motor skills, his speech, or his hand, his right side of his body being paralyzed. So now it's approaching my birthday, and I'm thinking, all right, for my birthday month, I'll have my little birthday vacation, and he can come, and I'll just sort it all out. I was gonna stay a month. I went March 23rd to sign the paperwork to release him, basically saying, once you leave, to get back in the facility, you would have to go through the whole process, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, medication, this is how you would continue, all that sort of stuff, discharge. That was on the 23rd. I think it was a Wednesday. It was about 12 o'clock. I went had lunch with him. I would always go in there, cut his hair. They had like a little barber salon thing in there, so I could go cut his hair in there. So I cut his hair. We ate lunch, and I sort of, gave him the plan. Hey, this is your last couple of days. Work hard in therapy, and we'll be out of here. And he was, obviously so excited. He's been freaking ready to break out the place. And I hated it. I didn't want him to be in there any longer than he had to. It was to the point where I was almost putting him at risk by forcing him staying in my house, and just wasn't cut out for it. And you need professional help at that point. And so it was the Wednesday, the 23rd, and we were supposed to leave, I think right around my birthday, that same, I think like the 27th or something like that. And I left at lunch about 12:30, 1 o'clock, went to training. They called me like right as I got home from training, like 6 or 7, and said that he had passed. I mean, they called me while I was at training. And it's like right as I'm coming, just in the timing, they call April second time. And then here comes April running in the house, like, and her face was just like pale. And I thought it was something with the baby, but I was like, what's up? And she's like, she couldn't even say it. She's like, the nursing home called. I already knew. I just like hauled ass. And they said he had just coded. Like, I think he had like an embolism or something, like an aneurysm. Like one of the blood clots in his brain had moved or something. So he had passed that same day, hours after I saw him. I just spent all my money, all the remaining money I had to afford to just spend one time. I just bought 2 tickets. You know how Leon is. I'm like, shit, they're not gonna give me my money back. But then I'm in the nurse home, like obviously with him. I call my sisters, like I'm here with daddy, he passed. Again, I have to sort of
stoic face.
Yeah, I have to even on the phone, call his brother, call everybody I have to call. I'm not really allowed to break down yet. And then I'm like, not even really breaking down that he's passed, because I've been with him. And I'm almost at a point of, well, at least he's not suffering, the whole sort of thing. But wait, what the hell do I do now? Who do I call? Like, who do you call when someone dies? Or like, what do you do? What do you sign? Like, I don't know any of this stuff. I'm a guy, I'm a bachelor. I just got out of college. I'm still drunk from my senior year. I don't know what's going on. And sure enough, so the lady sort of, I don't have any money. I'm like, he wants to be buried in St. Vincent or in Melbourne. I don't have money to get into either one of those places. Mm-hmm. So the nursing home ended up raising like $6,000. Dr. Ambrose gave me $1,000. People just pulled together. One of my good friends from home, Mike, gave me $500. So I got a lot of quick support. So within a week, ended up raising $7,000 to do a wake on my birthday, March 29th. And then, go back like 2 weeks. My dad's sort of had that stroke incident the day of our game at Coker. Mm. Because the money was not doing it, I had already been applying to other jobs. I get a call basically maybe 2 or 3 weeks before he passed that I got the job at University of South Carolina Sumter as the head coach. So like I had my son dealing with my dad. Mm-hmm. And now I just got the job that I thought I was going to grad school to hunt for. Like, this is why I need a master's. Sure enough, they hire me, and then 2 weeks later show up to my dad's funeral to give their condolences. So this is really up and down. And then, of tour, so they raised the money, helped me send him over to St. Vincent and do the funeral there in St. Vincent, doing all these things for my dad. That was the first glimpse into being responsible to the level of parenthood that I've ever had. Basically, I lost my dad in gaining my son, and that sort of cycle of life prepared me, I think, to somewhat to be a dad. I'm still learning, but I'm still recovering, I think, from that whole incident with my dad financially. You know, I had to borrow a lot of money to do that. And in the meantime, I'm like fighting with all my siblings. You know, the grief has their heads gone. We've all been very disconnected from my dad. So like a lot of like stuff is like coming out the dark, or it's just so unknown, and nobody knows when he was divorced or if it really was, or did he have a will? Did he not have a will? I was the power of attorney. So now, of course, it looks bad that I end up doing the process of the will. And he made it clear from years ago that I'm his namesake, I'm his junior, and he felt to put my name on the will. I never asked for that, I never wanted that, but I'm still dealing with that. So yeah, so I really went through it. Either way, so my dad never was close to. Come time I finish college, I'm sort of breaking into the adult world, take in my dad because he's dying. I have my son. Fortunately, I've had like 3 months there between, or a few months between November him being born and the next year in March.
So again, your son Aaron, born November 2016, your dad passes
March
of 2017.
Yes.
So... So he got to see your son.
Yeah, got to spend some time. Mostly at that point was in a nursing home. You know, of course, you always wish you could have spent more, or took him every time I went. A lot of the time, of course, he was fragile and newborn, so I wasn't carrying him out of the house anywhere. But I was glad that I was able to share that, like that my dad could see his son have a son. I think that was important.
You mentioned the word cycle a couple times. Again, just to remind folks, for anybody who might be just joining us now, I'm talking to my friend Joel Bristol, 26-year-old young man who's relaying stories about the passing of his father, the last year that he spent taking care of him. Father passed in March of 2017. Joel's first son was born in November 2016, so there was a little bit of time that his father got to see Joel become a father. And again, in that, you mentioned the cycle of life, and anybody who's been listening understands, I mean, you have an emotional depth to you, a certain intelligence to you, not stammering for words to express yourself. But you mentioned the cycle part. So, I mean, they don't know you're maybe not a religious person, but a spiritual person who believes in something beyond this. Whatever it is, I'm not too sure,
yeah,
but something beyond this. So did you see that in that moment, the fact that your dad was around long enough to see sort of a cycle complete that you became
the father? Yeah, it's almost frustrating because it's like a stupid-ass story. Like it's like a movie or some Netflix crap. Like where...
Don't hate on Netflix, man. It's all free. It's all good.
But it's like, to me, I almost try to seek out those patterns in life and in the events, like to justify, like, oh, I lost $5 today. Well, when I was 10, I stole that candy bar. That was at least $5. So I try to equate, like...
Balance the universe.
For sure. So there's a point where, like, I'm looking at it, and I'm like, well, I wasn't ready for a kid. So, like, I'm freaking out, and I'm sure April was too. But in my head, I at least have some consolation at the time that now, after that, while I'm freaking out about having a kid, trying to prepare myself mentally, I almost get distracted from that stress by my dad's condition now. I told him I had a son the day he was diagnosed with cancer. She was already like a few months pregnant. So while we're in the hospital, I was like, well, shit, now it must better be the time to tell him now, because maybe it'll lift his spirits up. Right. And I felt it did. The day he got the cancer diagnosis, when I told him we were having a kid. But I was almost like, damn, is it literally like that? Like, as I have my son, I lose my dad. And it's like, well, now I can't have any reservations about having a son, because I'm hoping he comes faster. I want him to be here in time to share some of my dad. I definitely sort of saw the cycle, and I think it became like there's things that they can't be coincidence. Like it's almost like God has humor. God's not going to make it easy for you. Like, I'm not like very hocus pocus about things, but there was times there where I was like, This is right out the Bible.
Give me examples.
There's like a point where like even now it's like deja vu. Like the point where I'm bathing my dad. I remember he had an ischemic attack, like a mini stroke they call it. Obviously in the moment wasn't thinking of it in that way. But either way, he's like, oh, you know, I'm not feeling good, whatever. And his side went weak, and he kept having problems with incontinence. And I think we had this sort of unspoken like understanding that like I'm not wearing no fucking underwear. Like no pampers, right? Yeah, like I think we never spoke a word, but he and I were very much the same wavelength. Very much so. What we both thought was stupid, or someone who we thought was soft, or someone who we thought was respectable, I think we always judged things very much the same. There's a point where I really just felt like it was almost predictable. You know, he's dying, or my son's born, and then, you know, he dies the day I sign him out of the thing. As if it was like God saying, you know, look, he would have died on the plane, or he would have died over there, and this whole process would have been so much harder or more stressful. Or so, and then the wake is it. I didn't even mean to do that. The time frame. He gets embalmed. I give my family time to travel up from Florida or wherever. It's on my birthday. It's on a Saturday or wherever it was. Do that on my. His funeral was on my birthday, for the wake. So I spent my whole birthday just with my dad. You know, in the funeral home, and then of course fly him over. So that was sort of like full circle. I definitely felt the sense of accomplishment getting him to St. Vincent, knowing that's sort of where he wanted to be buried. And and again, I think it was all very poetic, like being able to get him back to his homeland and do the funeral. Very like African-esque funeral. I'm sure you've seen some of the Vinci ones where it's like a community event. Parade, there's a, you know, the marching band, everybody's carrying branches and tree leaves or leaves and limbs. And that was the first time I also was able to help my sisters come over. They had never been to St. Vincent, but that was their first time. Unfortunately, my dad passed, but that was something as well. I was like, they had to come then. They had never been there. They wanted to. I know my dad wanted them to, but they never really got there. So they got there finally too. But yeah, things definitely came full circle. And it was a case where I sort of felt the passing of the torch sort of feeling. Like I felt the responsibility to sort of carry on the legacy. The only other elder male in my dad's family, like in my generation, was actually murdered the year before, and who I named my son after, my cousin Aaron. Was also now after a troubled youth getting into college and had got his mind right, had been to St. Vincent before, wanted to work with youth. Someone who would have been now in my lifetime a great asset. You know, now 3, 5, 6, 7 years later, would have been a great asset. You know, a few years ahead of me, had the connections, had the insight, and so young enough to be my boy. He was murdered, and so I sort of felt like, well, shit, I'm the last of the Mohicans. Like, you know, so a lot of pressure in that sense. And then talking about cycle, I definitely felt like it was very, very literal. My dad's dying, my son is being born, and I'm sort of in the middle, trying to, you know, balance both. Come sing with me. Say it loud. Won't you say?
Told him in the living years. Won't you sing with me? Sing it loud. Sing it loud. Won't you sing?
I mean, what did you learn from your dad in the 13, 14 months that watching him?
Yeah, so sorry, there was, you had asked, sort of went on a tangent.
Like, what's the first thing you're going to tell Aaron when Aaron is ready for that moment? You're going to say, look, man, you missed a guy, but I got to tell you about my dad.
See, and this is where it's almost frustrating, is because there was such a limited dialogue. And when I got him living with me, the first thing that was like severely affected was his speech. He was unable to articulate. And even then, mind you, my dad, and this is where I start to get into, I said, I had to look back and say, why the hell am I in this position now? And how could it have been, with all respect to losing someone to death, like how could this have went better? And it's almost like, that's when it was like, well, shit, what role does my dad being a black immigrant in America have to do with this? Or just in the world in general, the plight of the succession of black men throughout time, throughout generations. And the fact that my dad didn't have but maybe an elementary primary school education. He was a labor immigrant, in a sense, was very limited in his education. There were safety nets, the most basic sense of like insurance and life insurance policies, things like that, that he had no real grasp of to sort of safeguard his own assets or his kids afterwards. Even if my dad felt something, I really feel there was...
The language
wasn't there to articulate what he would want to say. Because there were times where I asked him in St. Vincent, we were still decent, we were taking those pictures in Mount Wynn and things. I'm like, you know, daddy, what do you... You know, the life pondering question. Like, what do you want? Like, what do you... You know, what do you want me to do? Like, what are my instructions? And it was always very, very, like, blunt, very short, never very, I don't want to say not thoughtful, but not complex. It was just very, just, you know, be happy or something very, very, you know, very basic. To tell Aaron, I mean, I really don't know where I begin other than to just tell him the storyline. And I think from that, he would sort of have to draw his own conclusions. Obviously, I love my dad. Never had any issues with him. No negative sort of interaction. So other than the story, just given the testimony, and I think that would sort of paint the picture. Luckily, we have, you know, photos and things of them together. I don't know if there's much else. There's no extended sort of stories that we had or moments other than sort of the tragedy going to the end while Aaron was born.
What was communication like? So if expression is not the best thing the Caribbean men do, if that wasn't there, and then physically, the stroke prevents him from saying anything.
Yeah.
Even if it's just short, curt, I guess basic type of communication. Yeah. What is the communication? Because you said that. You said that you guys had a tight bond, almost twin kind of relationship where you knew what he wanted.
It was a point where I was finishing his sentences. So I'm like working through his thoughts. And there's points where like, there's things he had never told me before, I'd never heard before. But I'm like reading his energy, his body language, and I always tried to do it well so that he wouldn't get frustrated, like trying to stutter out the word. I really don't know. There was just like this like supernatural connection by being with him so long. Like I was speaking for him. I'd be living vicariously through him. It was very, very surreal. I think even times April would say things like, how the hell did you know he was going to say that? Or like, how the hell do you understand what he's saying? And because he wouldn't get a single clear word out, or it'd be totally incomprehensible things sometimes they say, and I just have an idea of context, what he's looking at, how he's saying it, his face, whatever it was. The communication was never very wordy. It was more feelings. It was a vibe. And then you just get connected. You get very used to them being around. It's very much you get a glimpse of what it's like to be a dad. Your kid can't talk to you.
So that was my next question. Do you ever feel...
There's times when I'm looking down at my baby.
Exactly.
And like, so the time when my dad fell down and like had got weakness in his side, and with the incontinence, he had been trying, I was trying to rush him. Mind you, he's like three times my size. So when he's dead weight on one side, I'm like, he's about to crush me. Like, I'm about to collapse, trying to get him to this little doorway to the bathroom in the house. And he had like peed on his pants, and he would do that sometimes. We struggled with that. And I knew that like, it was embarrassing for him, for me to see him like wet his pants. And again, you get to a point as a man, it's like, oh, that would be awkward. No, you get right over it. Like, very quick. It's like with changing a diaper, like, oh, it sounds nasty, but you get right over it. So there was a point where I like bathed him in the tub and helped him bathe. That was the most sentimental, emotional, physically affectionate moment I had ever had. He had like just started breaking down, and I could tell it was just, he was just so fed up like of being so dependent. And I felt like he was so appreciative of me still being there, seeing me sort of struggle with having a new baby and going through the school stuff and losing my scholarship. I tried not to tell him it in a way that made it seem like his being there lent to that. But it was like, he was so appreciative of me, but also so mad and frustrated and sad and just feeling like he's dying and he's losing it. Like all those emotions. He just sort of started, broke down and was like boo-hoo crying. And at that point, I couldn't even sort of contain it. So like, we sat there like crying. And like, so he's like laying down in the tub, and I just sort of like holding his head and whatever it was, like just forehead to forehead, like a freaking movie. And then there's a point now, like every now and then I'll be like bathing my son. And I was like, holy shit, like deja vu. I get the same vibe. And like this, you end up developing this bond, although still the baby cannot speak, cannot use sentences. There's just some like spiritual understanding and sort of connection that goes on. And I think I was sort of given the key to that realm by taking care of my dad. So when I got into my son, I guess I felt prepared, or I sort of felt the sort of comfort, like, you know, this is my dad's contribution to my son's life, somehow or another. Yeah.
Do you think at the end of the day, besides the practical things that you have to teach a child, specifically a young man, and more pointedly a young, well, now biracial son, there are specific things that you want to teach him about the way the world is going to be and what should probably be your best reaction to things. But beyond that, fatherhood is that other thing, that other realm, that other understanding. Do you think part of it, and again, going back to sort of the spirituality aspect, the circle, the cycle, that was his final lesson, to impart that, even though he could not physically, that somehow that was transferred to you through him and through that experience? The other stuff, some dude can teach him how to drive. Some dude can teach him, you know, how to tie a tie. Mm-hmm. But that thing, I mean, what's the value of that thing to you now?
I feel that in terms of leaving a legacy, even if it's not wealth or anything like that, like literally having a prince to succeed the king, I love that I had a son. It's almost like a...
There's a lineage, there's a masculinity, there's a sense of...
Like preservation, like, you know, having my son and my dad sort of passing, very grounding. It was very much brought me to, I think, almost a morbid sense of reality. Like, I don't want to say hopeless, but like, I just sort of just lost. Like, I'm not surprised by tragedy, by... Like, I almost lost a level of sensitivity. I almost got a little bit callous, I think, in a way. Because I guess suffered through that year. But
how about the women in your life? We've been talking about your dad, but I mean, they're watching their favorite man go through this, namely your mom. What did you learn about your girlfriend April and your mom during this process?
Well, for April at least, you know, she's 8 months pregnant. I'm telling her, hey, I'm only making $600 a month. at the moment, and that's exactly Rent. And I'm saying, here I am saying, bring my dad in, and that's gonna take all kinds of other help and responsibility. Mm-hmm. I don't think she felt she had an alternative. Like, my dad's dying, and I'm saying he has nowhere to go, and I'm moving him in here. You know, I don't think she would have dared to say no. She'd maybe feel terrible for that, but she didn't just allow it. She definitely actively took part in it. I think she spent as much time with my dad alone as I did in that time, because I would go to work in the morning and they would always sit and eat breakfast together, and spend time in the mornings. So, she got close to my dad, really got fond of him. So I think, she got attached to him as well. So she definitely deeply impacted by, him passing. And being, obviously with me, that, she sort of shared in my sorrow. And anytime I say I took care of my dad, I have to say it was me and April, because it very much was.
Well, I'm making sure you say that. I had to make sure. Yeah, yeah. If we're going to do a podcast, I had to make sure that's
April,
brought up here.
April and I definitely, took care of my dad while he was, there at the house with us. Especially in terms of, cooking and things like that. She definitely always made sure he ate.
She's an amazing cook. What about your mom? Now, they've been separated since
I was a year old.
Okay, and what was her participation in the, not participation, her role in the process?
All I could really get, so all I got was advice. Financially, no one in my family was in a position to assist me. Physically, they weren't in a position to assist me. My mom drove right up to be with me, and of course, knowing that I didn't know how to navigate the paperwork of it, she came right up, drove up, took off work, whatever it was, came up to sort of just be with me, in the moment. And my dad had other female friends, who I, in a word, just call girlfriends, who helped, who at least would call and show concern. And if that was the most help they could give, then I appreciated it. But the other side of that was the battle now with my oldest sister, who felt, hard done by, because she's the oldest, got the least really, at least in her mind, from my dad. She was a teenager, and he goes, immigrates to America, never looks back, and is close with his ex-wife. And, in a time when I'm thinking they're gonna assist me, and especially my older sister, they're plotting and scheming to get a hold of the land. And it's not even the sense that there's so much and it's so worthy of something to fight about. I think for her, she just felt spited, like how dare he give it to the youngest and not the oldest. And of course I'm the junior, so they just felt like I was privileged, I got to grow up with him. Mm-hmm. And they didn't get to see him much at all, and how dare he leave that to just me. And he excluded them from the will. And again, it was all in the same. I think my mom's done the same. I'm just trustworthy. And in their mind, it could be $1 million they bequeathed to me, and they would trust me to probably give all my family and siblings all of it. Mm-hmm. Much more than I take. So not worried about some scandalous stuff going on. So he trusted me. And for the whole last year, I was doing all the paperwork for him. So
not to get into it. Is there anything to sort of wrap that part of it up, because we didn't get into it too much, and we could, because we
just
talked
have
about...
a, have like, and I told this to all my boys now, especially the ones who have Caribbean dads with several kids, several baby mothers from all over the place, get a freaking will written now. It's gonna inevitably go through all this tussling and family feuding, but it's helpful to have that out of the way.
What have you learned about family in general? Now, again, you have a son who's about 15 months now.
I mean, you start to realize that, you have a lot of family, but you don't have a lot of help. They might think of you. They might give you a word of encouragement. But at the end of the day, you're really on your own. And you end up having, a friend or a girlfriend who replaced what you think is family. It makes me want to build a much tighter family unit. Although my family being broken up has nothing directly to do with race, you now recognize where, if over generations, somehow or another, black families are kept broken, that it's inevitable. Financially, they're going to be... I'm not being passed on $1 million inheritance to start my own. I'm getting the exact opposite. I'm inheriting debt and drama and mystery. You know, my other peers throughout their dad's life might have a longer life expectancy because he was more literate, more aware of health, had more access to health. They maybe have a better job and at least life insurance. Or maybe they're passing over something that's worth some value. And so, like, again, over generations, I recognize, so for me, passing on a legacy through the Bristol bloodline, I'm the first one with a college degree in any concept of preserving an extended legacy, period. My dad labored on what was effectively a sugar plantation post-abolition. So still slavery, but you're getting a dollar for every million that they make off the crop. I'm now in the 21st century for my father's bloodline, the first one poised to even begin an idea to tell the younger ones, hey, I'm going to pass this on to you, so you need to be competent and able to preserve this once more. And again, so to my son and to my nephews, or even to my peer, the men peers that I have in the family, it had to start somewhere. ...2017 was probably the most transformative year of my life in that I think I experienced some of the worst and best of life. And I think even like in my father's death, like I found myself sort of thinking like on his legacy, what has he left for us? Like as a black man, an immigrant at that, like, you know, would he have felt his life was fulfilled? Like how could he have done more to leave behind for his kids? Sort of in his estate, and like for me, like this, I can almost relate every single thing about like the history of race, I guess, all the way down the rabbit hole, like to my own life. And I think there was ways that it just seemed like things that were always been concepts about race were like actually affecting my life. It felt like, and it just sort of came to a climax. Like I think that was the angriest I felt discussing race with some of my family. Friends, like that's when the quote, to be relatively conscious in America is to be in a constant state of rage.
Baldwin,
that's definitely where I felt that was at a point. Some of it was like just, I think, other frustrations and sort of aggression, maybe grief sort of manifesting itself.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Ubuntu Radio. Come back for more of my conversations with Mr. Joel Bristol about race and the present state of America. For now, we are out.